Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. I'm your host, Stone Payton, joined by my co-host, Lee Banter.
Oh, Lee Banter? Thanks. Good one. That's why we have a script. Lee Cantor is here to tell you about our sponsor, Stone. Would you like to know? We have Turning Point Strategy sponsoring the show today. They're branding consultants who measurably, dramatically improve sales by helping clients clearly define and communicate their difference in the market. Their core service, offering chaos to clarity, analyzes the critical growth gaps in your business, establishes a new brand blueprint, and equips you to attract, convert, and retain more customers at higher margins. That's tpstrategies.com, 678-727-4040.
Thank you, Lee Cantor. We do have a great show for you this morning. We're going to talk to an expert in recruiting and retention, and then we're going to visit with a gentleman around this idea of demand chain innovation. But first up, Ken Tanner is in the house. Ken Tanner started his career scrubbing dishes for Pizza Hut, so I'll be interested to hear a little bit more about that. But at some point, he obviously earned a few badges and is now a very highly regarded recruiting and retention expert. And he's author of at least a half a dozen books that I know about, including my favorite, Never Order Barbecue in Maine. But most recently, he's released The Entrepreneur's Guide to Hiring and Building the Team. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Thank you, Payton. Good to be here.
We want to talk to you about this recruiting and retention business, and specifically on retention. I'm curious, what is it that makes one employee leave and the guy in the next cubicle stay indefinitely?
You hit the exact word, one employee. The trouble is we try to solve retention problems by having a program to cover all the employees, but the way you keep employees is one at a time. And the way you do that is recognize it just like you do with sales. With sales, you find a need and you fill it. Well, with employee retention, you find their needs and fill it. And the needs for one person in one cubicle are completely different, usually, than the next one over and the next one over from that. So identify what it is the employee needs out of the job and deal with that.
Can you do that in a way that's a system so that it can be implemented across the board?
Actually, that's almost an oxymoron with that. What you need to do, and the method is simply talk to them. At various stages in the employment, from the time you first interview them, all the way through every annual review, you just sit down with somebody and ask them what I call the question. And that is, you would say, let me ask you something. If you were to leave this company and go to work for someone else, what would probably be the reason? Whatever reason they give you is the one you need to look out after. Now, if there's a long, silent pause and then they just say, I don't know, maybe more money, you're doing okay. Because they haven't thought about it.
So the more money, that's like their default
answer? That's exactly right. It's the default answer. Now, it's not the default answer if you say, if you were to leave the company, what would probably be the reason? They say money, okay? They've thought about it. If they give you a quick answer, they've put some thought into that, mm-hmm. and you need to run, don't walk, and relate to that. And these answers can be most anything. You'll see folks saying, I'd like some education or some training. I'd like a promotion. Sometimes it's I have kids that need child care.
Right, like more flexibility.
Flexibility is a huge response to it. Rarely is the answer actually more money. Very rarely.
So what's the new book about?
The next one is called The Boomer's Career Survival Guide. And it's a lot like a barbecue in Maine insofar as it is it's a kind of a primer for the baby boomers, which I'm flat in the middle of, on how to handle their career. And it's needed for two reasons. Things have changed. First of all, the world has changed. The way you go about getting a job and building a career, even retiring, is nothing like it used to be in the past. And the second thing is the boomer has changed. You've changed. Where you are now in your life, the things you need out of life, the things you want out of life, are nothing like they were when you were 20, 25 years old. So I'm going to address this issue of for the baby boomer on what to do with their career from now through what used to be called retirement. It's my theory there's no such thing as retirement anymore. It's taken on a whole new definition. But it's from middle age through retirement, how to handle your life.
Is career also a misnomer?
Yes, it is, because you have several careers, really, in your... That's a great question. You have several careers in your life. Now, it used to be that career just spoke to what you did to earn a paycheck. Now it has to do with a paycheck. It also has to do with what you do for personal satisfaction, self-actualization. It also has to do with your family and your friends and environment. So career is one of those words now that has so many different definitions, it might not have a definition.
So what should companies be doing differently with respect to baby boomers, either on recruiting or retention?
With baby boomers, for the biggest thing on recruiting is retention. Let me explain that. The population, the baby boomers did a lot of things right, but one thing we did not do very well was reproduce. The next generation that's coming in has a much smaller population than the baby boomers have. So as baby boomers retire and move on and start their own businesses, which a great many of them are doing, you don't have this giant labor pool to draw from. And so if you want to hold on to your workforce, you retain those baby boomers, not as in the past, look to always be bringing in fresh blood, new blood, and so forth. One of the key things I advise clients to do, and I work a lot with accountants, is to advise their clients that don't let them retire. If anything else, put them on part-time status. Now, when a person retires, they usually spend about a month, 2 months, enjoying sleeping late on the couch and going fishing, but that gets pretty boring after a while. They will want to go back to work, but they don't want to go back full-time. So here you have this scenario. You have somebody who is quite skilled at what they're doing that wants to work part-time in that profession. And you also, there's something else they bring to the table, and that is most of them, at least if they're professionals, will bring in a lot of clients. If you're an accountant, an attorney, or whatnot, and you come back from retirement to working part-time, you'll probably bring a lot of those clients with you, and that's a huge benefit to that business. But let's say they do come back part-time. Let's say it's an accountant. Here you pick up flexibility as an employer. You can have them work like crazy during tax season, and then the slower season, you get to have them not work, so you don't carry that huge expense all the time, but they're there when you need it. In retail, you can divide a job into two, and then during the regular part of the year, they split a job, but then when it comes into the Christmas season, you have both of them work, and that deals with your seasonality. But again, these are more mature workers. They're great at training. They're great mentors. They have the client relationship, and you don't have to pay them benefits because they're working part-time, for Pete's sakes. It is a big, big win for the employer.
Now, is this something that how do they relate with the younger worker? You know, when you have the person that's nearing the classic age of retirement, and then you have somebody that's 20 years old, you know, they're looking at life through totally different lenses here.
They are, and they're complementary lenses in most cases. If you have two 20-year-olds, they're at each other's throat trying to get promoted over the other one.
Right.
Now you've got a guy that's, you know, the older and wiser mentor and is there to say to that 20-year-old, let me tell you something. Let me show you an idea.
Is the 20-year-old open to that?
We're talking Generation Y now.
Right.
They are notoriously stubborn. However, the wise ones, the ones that will find a way up, will take coaching. So Generation Y is a little bit different quite a bit different than the boomer generation.
They have different expectations, right?
They do, and they're more cynical, and they're less loyal. They're less loyal in this regard. They're no longer a cub or a brave or a Yankee. They are third basemen or left fielders or pitchers.
Mm-hmm. So what role does the immediate boss play in all this, and where do they screw it up? What kind of mistakes do they make?
The number one reason that employees say they leave a job is they have a bad boss. Now, I have invested the last two or three years trying to define what is a bad boss. What does that mean?
You need some help?
Well, here I have come up with my HR theory that will be, I guess, edged on my tombstone. We've all known bosses that were incompetent or had bad tempers or things like that, but yet their people just absolutely love them. And then we've had bosses that were quite capable and followed the book and so on and so forth, keep losing people. The difference is accessibility. A good mm-hmm. boss is someone who is accessible. And for this reason, at all times in our careers, we face times when we're vulnerable for leaving. A headhunter might call us. We might have problems at home. We might have money crunch. Just all the different reasons for leaving, but we all have it. Now, if you catch that early and sit down with the employee and say, you know, what can we do? How can I help you? You're going to be able to save that person. However, if the employee does not feel their boss is accessible and they avoid the boss, then whatever issue this is, let's say it's a headhunter calling them, it's going to fester and fester and fester. It's going to get blown out of proportion. And by the time the boss finds out about it, it is too late to deal with. So what is a good boss? A good boss is one that's easy to talk to and is accessible. That's it.
How are you defining accessible? Just easy to talk to is one thing, but it's also, are they really listening?
Yes. It's someone that you feel comfortable about walking into their office, putting your feet up on the desk and saying, Bob, I got to tell you about something. If it's a formal atmosphere, or if it's very stilted or a class system that exists where you don't feel comfortable talking to Mr. Smith or making an appointment to go see Mr. Smith, then that's not going to have much potential for keeping that employee.
So it creates that environment of kind of distrust where they already have one foot out the door?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's distrust. It's more of it takes the boss out of the equation. The employee just doesn't even think about going to see him or her
to solve the problem.
With their problems.
Right.
Okay.
So what's the secret to hiring top performers? How do you find them and how do you keep them?
Well, I mentioned to you the employee says that the number one reason for leaving is the boss. Actually, the number one reason for someone leaving a company is a job mismatch. The way you keep people is to put them in the right job to start with. And both the employee and the employer have to share responsibility on this. Here's a typical scenario when filling a job. You had a person working for you who left 2 months ago. You haven't been able to fill that job. Things are going crazy, and you've just got to get somebody to do that job. Now, on the other side, in the waiting room is a guy that used to be a lion tamer, and you're trying to fill a job.
But he has a pulse.
He has a pulse.
And he's available now.
But his mortgage is due. In a couple of days, or else he's going to lose his house. You know the story. He has money. He doesn't even have money to buy gas, even if he could get to a gas pump that had it in there. And so he's made his mind up before he talks to anybody, I'm going to get this job. Now, you get these two people together, the chances of actually finding a good job match are zero or worse. And so this lasts about 3 months until he can find another job. Most of the reasons that we aren't able to hold on to our employees, the biggest reason is they shouldn't have been there to start with. So I would say the prime thing for an employer to do is have the patience to find the right fit, even if you've got alligators snapping at your heels.
That sounds like great advice. We're about out of time, but before we let you go, a couple of things. If our listeners want some more professional counsel on some of these issues, how do they get to you? Where can they contact you?
Well, thank you. I'd love to hear from anyone that has a question or needs any help. You can reach me. My phone is 678-231-0679, and my email is kentanner@consultant.com.
All right.
And your website?
www.kentanner.net.
Great. Listen, before we let you go, Ken, we wrap every high-velocity interview with this last question. We ask our guests to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career and what they learned from it. Would you do that for us?
Yeah, you don't have enough time for me to mention a lot of them. The one that I remember so much, and the moral of the story I'll tell you on the front end, is when the brass ring comes around, you need to grab it. But I was a regional vice president with a company, and I'd have been VP there for about 3 months. And a division VP job opened up, and all the regional guys were being interviewed. Well, I didn't think I'd been around to have a chance, so I thought it would be politically brilliant to admit that on the front end and even suggest someone else to be for that job. Well, I did that, and very humbly. And then, interestingly enough, my boss's boss actually hired the person that I recommended. And I was feeling pretty cocky about this, and I called the company's senior VP of HR to kind of brag on myself. And he let me know, he said, "Ken, you were the odds-on favorite for that promotion, but Paul thought that you were just too tentative and you weren't aggressive enough, so you didn't get the job." And I realized that I didn't think that through. The point is, the promotions and the brass rings come around on its own schedule, not yours, and you need to adapt to that schedule rather than waiting for things to fall into place on yours.
That certainly sounds like sound advice. Ken, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Stone. Loved it.
We'll have you back.
Great.
Next up is Zahir Palanpour, who is president of Azul Arc International, which is an interactive design and software development firm. And these guys really are international. They've got clients across the globe and production facilities in the U.S., India, and Colombia. And I was reading in your bio, Zahir, somewhere within your career, you won something called the Matthew Douglas Entrepreneurship Awards. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Stone. That's an award that I won while going to business school here in Atlanta at Emory, and it was an open merit award based on writing about your ideas on entrepreneurship, ideas that you had about possibly starting a new business. And this was, of course, a business school when I was in my early 20s, and based on what I put together, I was very excited to learn from the school when I got back from the holidays that I was awarded that scholarship. It certainly helped pay the heavy dues at Emory, too. So there was a double positive impact there.
I'll bet. And an encouraging start to your career.
Yes. It was something that sort of definitely helped in my confidence to think that at some point and at some stage in my life, I'd love to go out and start my own company, something that I'd always had in mind. And about 12 to 14 years after working in corporate America, I finally made that leap. And certainly, you know, that in the background did give me that extra push to go out and say, you know, I can go out and try and do this.
Yeah. Well, the advanced press that I gave our conversation today was that you would give us some insight into this idea around demand chain innovation. Can you expand on that and tell us what that's all about?
Certainly. Demand chain innovation is about looking at the front-end aspect of your company, about those activities that you engage in from your product and from your company standpoint out to your customer. It's those sales, marketing, customer-related activities and all the support service elements that you bring around in actually delivering your product or service to your customer. The idea has been around for a little while, but if you really look outside there, for the last many years, a great focus and emphasis has been paid towards supply chain and operational excellence. There's been a lot of work, a lot of system application into supply chain management, supply chain innovation, operational innovation, innovating around your products through how you produce and bring it to market. Not as much attention, and I'm glad to say that more and more this is changing, particularly with some innovative and a few of the larger companies. There is an emphasis of applying those same ideas to your demand chain, to bringing in much more system and much more innovation and organization and efficiency to your marketing, sales, and customer-related functions to help bring about changes in that area.
So, in general, is the industry getting better at this? Are they right now not very good at it, and that's where you come in? What's the state of the industry on this?
I think so. And, you know, there's been some early examples of companies doing this. You know, Levi's coming in and introducing these custom, very innovative custom fit solutions would be an example. Some of these earlier examples also didn't quite succeed, so we actually have a lot to learn from some of this, the Levi example being one of them. But more and more, that definition essentially of innovation and bringing about efficiencies and savings within your company to help grow the top line as well as manage your cost is being applied here. It's allowing you to become much broader about how you think about innovation. Innovation is not just about coming up with a cool product. It can be about how your customers find you. Thinking of new and innovative ways on how your customers find you. Innovative ways on how you can help yourself get selected in their choice-making process. Innovative ways in which you can help finance and make them get what you're looking for, looking to serve them for. So you need to broaden the concept of innovation and how you can do that. And if there's one area that has opened up a lot of possibilities here, it's the idea of technology and the interactive medium that we have available to us. And that's been allowing us to do a lot more in this area.
Well, play that out for us a little bit. Can you share a client example and exactly what you did for them so we can get a handle on what it really looks like on the ground?
Certainly. And as I do that, I'd like to kind of maybe point out one or two interesting examples that are out there that might sort of highlight this concept. And I'll use one example on the technology side and one that is decidedly non-technology related. Think of everybody's familiar with ketchup and Heinz ketchup, right? Heinz sells tomato ketchup. There's not much you can do beyond that, right? It's tomato ketchup. And for the longest time, they were figuring out how to grow. And the answer didn't quite come in developing that new green ketchup. That was an absolute failure.
That didn't work out.
What happened was that, you know, they started looking beyond in ideas and innovation. They went in to see how customers were using their product. It was not so much their product, but how the customer was interacting and using their product. And then they just came up with a simple idea of putting the opening of the bottle at the bottom. So you had it tipped over.
I remember. Yeah.
You know what that did to their sales?
Mm-mm.
I believe it was over 70% of growth just from that one simple innovation.
Wow.
So that's a great example. Another good example is a new and upcoming company called Threadless.com. Now, this is in the interactive space. They have seen, in a very short period of time, with almost no advertising, sales grow from $0 to $30 million. And what they have come up with is just a very effective way of using basic Web 2.0 technologies about engaging with your user, the people out there. And they do this not only to buy their products, but they use their user community, so to speak, to design, select, and then buy their products. They built a system which allows anybody to go up there and submit designs for T-shirts. So somebody can go in there, submit a T-shirt design, and then the community there votes on those T-shirts. And the T-shirts that get the most votes, they actually manufacture and make available to that same community to sell.
Oh, now that's cool.
And from $0 to $30 million in a couple of years, and they've been heralded as sort of one of the most effective applications of Web 2.0 technologies.
Well, say more about Web 2.0, because I see that term. I don't know that I really have a handle on it. I mean, what all does that involve?
Well, Web 2.0, you know, you see it all around you. Good examples, Facebook.
Okay.
That involves, it's basically Facebook, MySpace.com,
right.
All these companies that are able to create community and allow a lot of interactivity and the ability to bring up video, sound, content from a greater community and centralize the complexity to allow people to bring in that input would classify as that. You know, YouTube would be another classic example.
And then the demand chain innovation connection is you're drawing on your community to contribute to the process.
Exactly. You're getting your community to help you design, but you're helping them select, helping them create the selection process too. And then you've created enough buzz and viral effect to actually be able to have the same group of people buy your products for you. So here they've almost used no marketing dollars at all to promote themselves because they've
really?
Just created so much excitement around what they're doing. So it's a totally different way of looking at how you're reaching your customers. And it's a total outside-in approach where you're taking the market and bringing it into your business versus the other way around.
Can you talk about what your business does to help facilitate that? Because it sounds like you're getting a lot of data in, but you still have to manage all that data in order to make good use of it?
Certainly. I can give you a couple of examples. We're actually taking some of these similar ideas, and we've got a process called U-Design, which we're applying to certain industries in the commercial interior products area that would allow designers across the United States to actually submit design ideas, then go through that same selection process and develop and then help develop the product. And we're going to actually then see that go through into the manufacturing process. So that's one example, and it's basically using the same technologies that are available out there. From a technology perspective, there's nothing that dramatic. It's just the business process that is innovative and that allows you to do these things.
Is this something you need, like, a huge budget to do, or can it be a...
Actually, no, not at all. In fact, these things can be done fairly economically. The other thing that you have working to your advantage is open source technologies. Most of you all have blogs, right?
Yeah.
To actually develop a blog from scratch would take quite a lot, but how easy is it to put one together right now? It's incredibly easy, and now you've just opened up a whole new form of interaction with your clients. So, you know, blogs, forums, some of these things that allow you to interact and engage with your clients is another format, and with open source being available, you can do these, and small businesses now can have this incredible capability available to them at very, very economical values.
And do some industries lend themselves more to these things than others, or are you finding it's working in manufacturing, financial services, all the sectors?
I think you can find it in every sector that you're in. I think you can find tools and technology to apply at every, no matter what business you're in. I just gave you an example of, you know, tomato ketchup and
right.
T-shirts. They're very, very different. So, yeah.
Are you finding that with the advent of the internet and the popularity and more people just embracing this, it's creating like a more collaborative relationship between the company and their customers?
Certainly. There's much more now available in terms of your ability to reach out, engage, and interact with your customers, your vendors, and the community that is built around what you do.
And then that works also. Are you finding more businesses collaborating with other businesses, and you know, to have a bigger kind of, they're making themselves appear bigger by collaborating with lots of other people?
Certainly, I think so, and I think a great example would be a group that I think many of us are aware of, Growth Answers, where a group of people who are experts in sales and marketing are able to come together and deliver a whole comprehensive set of services. And part of what allows us to do this is good communication and all the communication tools that allow us to be independent but yet together at the same time and effectively deliver together.
And do you guys have an event coming up?
Yes, we do. We have a monthly meeting called Meet the Expert, and the next one is on the 15th of October.
And you're the star, right?
And I'll be speaking at that one, yes.
That's how we found out about you. Got you on the show on the 15th of October?
That's right.
Okay. What time do you guys get together? 7?
7 in the morning, yes.
All right.
And where is that at?
That's at the Georgian Club.
Terrific. We're just about out of time, and in just a moment we're going to have one more question for you, but would you let our listeners know how they can get in touch with you and your team at Azul Arc International?
Sure. You can reach us. The best way to reach us, of course, is over the web. We believe that is the best medium since that's a lot of what we do. You can get us at www.azularc.com. That's spelled A-Z-U-L-A-R-C, azularc.com. And you can reach us over the phone at 404-551-4668.
And the website of Growth Answers also?
Yes. There is a Growth Answers website, too.
What's that?
That's www.growthanswers.com.
Terrific. Well, you know what's coming. We wrap every high-velocity radio interview with the same question. If you would, please share with us a mistake you've made somewhere in your career, and more importantly, what you learned from it.
Sure. I think I'll use a recent example, and that's, you know, being in the small to medium-sized business world, you're constantly working on balancing the short term, and keeping your hand on the short term with keeping your eye on the long term. And achieving that is sometimes easier said than done. And I think one of the mistakes that I made recently was sort of taking the eye off a little bit on the long term. It was about this time last year, sales were great. We were growing, doing a lot of interesting interactive and web projects. We had some great software development projects that we were working on. And we had more work than we could handle. So we sort of focused in a little bit more inward and ensure that, of course, we were doing well operationally and delivering effectively. But what that did was have us take off the accelerator on the sales side and the market development side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly with the slowing of the economy, that didn't help too much. So one did see that effect, and I think this is a challenge that all of us as smaller businesses face, because there is a cycle of, you know, a lot of work, and then you're very focused in on that, and then you may have that situation where things sort of fall off a bit. So it's critical, I think, that you keep constantly keep an eye on the mid to longer term while ensuring that you're succeeding in the short term.
So that's the lesson. You've got to maintain that. You got to strike that balance.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. Really enjoyed visiting with you, and hope to have you back soon.
Thank you very much.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton and Lee Cantor reminding you, faster really is better.